Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Kendall, and I will be the host for today's Hinckley Forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through a generous bequest of the Noble Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships to students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Hinckley Institute also offers classes, the nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and over $70,000 in academic scholarship. We invite students to go next door or to our website, www.hinckley.utah.edu, for more information. The title of today's forum is New Dynamics of U.S.-China Relations. Today's guest is Fusheng Wu, and he is the director of the Confucius Institute. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you. Actually, the guest speaker is Professor Zhao Quansheng from American University in Washington, D.C., and I'm here just to introduce him. The Confucius Institute is the organizing kind of party of this event, together with the Hinckley Institute of Politics. And today is a great pleasure and honor to have a very distinguished scholar on the campus, Professor Zhao Quansheng. He got his PhD from UC Berkeley, and he's now Professor of International Relations and Director of Center for Asian Studies and at American University in Washington, D.C. He's also a guest professor at Beijing University, Tsinghua University, Fudan University, and Korea University in South Korea. And he is the author of two books from Oxford University Press, and he is also published widely on U.S.-China relations and also on issues regarding foreign diplomacy. And he testified in the U.S. Congress regarding the U.S.-China relations and other topics as well. So without much ado, let us welcome Professor Zhao.
Good morning, everybody, and thank you for the Institute, and thank you for Professor Wu, Professor Tong. It's really a great pleasure to be here. Today's topic, as we all understand, is new dynamics of U.S.-China relations. What I'm going to do is to conduct a lecture for about 15 minutes, followed by Q&A. We will have time to have a lively interaction here. What is the new dynamics? The main theme of there are many different dimensions, political, economic, security, strategic, cultural, among others. But my lecture today will concentrate on this, what I called the emerging dual leadership structure in the Asia-Pacific. So this is a central theme. When I say dual leadership, I mean United States and China with different dimensions. What I would like to emphasize is the United States is a existing hegemon and the military security leader continue to play a leading function in Asia-Pacific, whereas China emerged as a regional economic leader. And the two powers need to accommodate each other, understanding each other, and on the one hand, cooperation to have this dual leadership. On the other hand, of course, competition. And if we use a new term created by the old China hand, Harry Harding, he, in his recent article, he used the term cooperation, competition, and the two words together, something like competition. You know, the typical scholar would like to create some new terms.
We're recording this, and if you don't stay by the podium, we can't hear you, so I'm
going to
give you this, okay?
Oh, I see. Okay. Sometimes I walk around
<That's fine. laughs>
like a university professor, right? except I don't ask a question. So in my own seminar, I always ask students, say, do you know where is the capital of China, right? So, something like that. But I'm sure here, everybody educated audience, so I would really prepared a dialogue with scholars, students here. This also in line with perception of American public opinion. Here, if you look at one of the most recent Pew Research Center public opinion survey about what do you think? Military power versus economic power in terms of leadership. If you look at here, economically, almost half American people here indicate they believe China, economic dimension. And 31%, less than 1%, one-third, say United States. I guess that's something to do with the 2008 financial crisis and economic slowdown for the past few years. And Japan, 9%, EU, 6%, other, or don't know, 7%. However, if we look at military dimension, two-thirds, very strongly, believe that United States is a leading power. And 16% China. Russia, 5. EU, 3. Others, 9. So my theme, more or less along this line, that is why there is such perception and how we see this new dynamics of U.S.-China relations. If we always start with IR theory and others, we are familiar with like so-called power transition theory in international relations, a relationship between rising power, which is China in this case, and the existing dominant power, which is the United States. The key issue is how the dominant power deals with the rising power. That's one of the key functions, this power transition theory. One of the keys for the peaceful transition whether there will be a peaceful transition or whether there will be a military confrontation. So those will be very key elements for the future. The day before yesterday, I flew from Washington Wednesday evening to Salt Lake City Airport. But lunchtime at American University, we had a conference. The keynote speaker is Kurt Campbell, Assistant Secretary of State for East Asia Affairs. And he delivered some lectures on U.S. foreign policy, and there are some Q&A. And I also raised my hand. We had good discussion. And Kurt Campbell, when there is a question that whether U.S. and China could possibly return to the 50s, that is the Cold War period, and Mr. Campbell saying, no way. Nobody wants to return to the 50s. Confrontation of Cold War and emphasizing both powers try to look for a accommodating ways to have a peaceful transition. At the same time, of course, he also emphasized we should stick to principle and others. So it's a very interesting and critical time. And key elements is for this peaceful transition is the degree of satisfaction, the rising power according to power transition theory. There are many articles, books about this. And the probability of conflict is greatest according to this school of thought when the relationship can be characterized as the zone of contention. What does that mean? That means when there is a parity appeared in terms of comprehensive power between the two countries would be the most dangerous period from IR perspective. We all understand there are rising power with historically we have Japan challenged China's dominance in terms of East Asia. China was a dominant power for several thousand years in East Asia, and there was an early power transition. And the result was the defeat of China, Qing Dynasty, and the Treaty of Shimonoseki, we all understand, and that's also relevant to today's conflict between China and Japan. And there are another, Germany challenge UK dominance, and also rising of Russia, a former Soviet Union, that's another case. The only peaceful transition is United States versus UK. So Bob Kagan, for example, argued that the most successful management of a rising power in a modern era was Britain's appeasement of the United States in the late 19th century. There are many different explanations about why and how this happened. So a lot of historical license people can learn and to see this power transition. So in other words, when we talk about this very critical time of U.S. versus China and whether there will be a peaceful time for the future, many historical lessons we may learn with previous rising power stories. Now, since my lecture today is somewhat deals with the issue of leadership, so we have to make a definition, you know, as any political scientist, we like to do that. Say, how do you define a leadership in international affairs? Here, at least five conditions. First of all, this international leadership is not self-appointed and not even elected. There is no such thing, election or appointment, but rather it's just emerged to play a leadership role with at least five conditions. First, it should be powerful in one or multiple dimensions. Powerful in economic, powerful in political, powerful in military, right? Both hard power and soft power, there are a lot of measures for that. Second, able to be able for rule-making process, to set up agenda, make rules in international stages. And thirdly, would play a leadership role in international organizations. We are all familiar with the United Nations, with World Bank, IMF, who play leading role in this international organizations also an indicator. And fourth, would be able to provide what we call the public goods, not only for military confrontation or economic rescue, but also whenever there is a need, this particular power could be able to provide public goods. Like when Indonesia, there is a tsunami or Japan earthquake, and who can provide some rescue forces in international order. That is the another criteria. And last and not least is what we always say is high moral position. So those and which, of course, refer to soft power, among others. So we will look at those categories for China and the United States to look at those issues and how one power could play a certain leadership role, but in other dimension cannot do that. Therefore, if there is a dual leadership structure, is a key. Whether this dual leadership structure can be maintained, one point, there are a number of things. If there is no cooperation, then there will be no dual leadership. So cooperation is key. Therefore, we will see a deliberate change of behavior contingent on changes in the other party's behavior. So there is, you know, each side need to have a effort, to make effort to accommodate and to change some practice and increases reward for each party. But this cooperation not same as harmony, whereas If there is a harmony, there are no deliberate change in behaviors necessary. So there are, here I just said some IR theory, like Bob Cohen theories, those people who had this kind of argument, and I used that. And examples we see post-Cold War security community, like NATO and others, and also U.S.-led military or financial coalition in war on Iraq, you know, that kind of, what do we say, a cooperation to play a leadership role. Now, let's pay a closer examination of China. Why we called the rise of China? We have number of dimensions. Economic dimension in particular, this is the place we discussed about so-called a leadership role. That is, China from 2 years ago, for the first time in modern contemporary history, now became number two economy, past Japan. GDP for the past 3 decades, average 10%, at the same time U.S. average 2.6%. Of course, we now see a slowdown of China's GDP economic growth, so there is a discussion about whether is a soft landing or hard landing, but still, even with the slowdown, it's still 7-8% of growth for this year, for example. Moreover, China now is the largest creditor of all foreign-owned U.S. Treasury securities. China constitutes more than 20%. So that's another indicator for a very deep interdependence between the United States and China. If we look at last year, the leading economic top 10, and who are they? We clearly see China now is about half of U.S. and also far ahead of Japan now, and then Germany, France, Brazil, U.K., Italy, Russia, and Canada. So this is a basic trend for the development. And moreover, China also played important trading. Now is a what we call Asian regionalism, East Asia, Southeast Asia, Oceania, and South Asia countries. Virtually every economy now with China is number one trading partner in Asia Pacific. Moreover, for 2008 financial crisis, and China played a what they called a economic engine for the recovery. There are some statistics numbers. Therefore, up to now, GDP growth largely depend on China's GDP growth and investment. Of course, again, we already mentioned the recent slowdown of China. So in this regard, there are some uncertainty. If we look at major economies, what are their trading partners? If we look at here, if we don't talk about China, let's look at it from U.S. down. Except NAFTA, we see China now is leading with United States. China also number two with EU, number two with India, number one Hong Kong, Australia, Japan, ASEAN, South Korea. And NAFTA countries, Canada, Mexico, US number one, China number two. So if we look at Asia Pacific, therefore, overwhelmingly, China and United States are number one, number two trading partners, but China apparently ahead in this international trade dimension. Treasury, China, China and Japan, number one, number two. Far ahead of all others combined. Actually, the two powers together almost constitute half of total debt of United States. Of course, now there is a debate, right, whether this country would like to be in that circumstances. But still, the net result is, again, it's economic interdependence, which never happened before with a rising power. For example, when Soviet Union challenged United States during Cold War, there are no economic interdependence between the two powers. It's basically military confrontation. And so one of the major differences between Soviet Union and China, there are many other dimensions like ideological and other issues, but economic interdependence is one of the most influential factors. Foreign reserve by country, again, China is bigger than the next two, at least combined, which include Japan and the Eurozone. Regional influence, as we can see economically, heavily depend on China. FDI, that is a foreign direct investment, into China on the rise. Moreover, China started to outflow, that is, overseas investment to not only its Asian neighbors, but projected globally, Latin America, Africa, and also this country. Therefore, if you look at top trading partners, we already mentioned to Japan, South Korea, EU, US, Singapore, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Australia, and others. So economic influence, economic power is really obvious. And free trade agreement also increased with Thailand, Pakistan, New Zealand, Singapore, Peru, ASEAN, and also so-called Greater China, that is Taiwan, Macau, and Hong Kong. Right now, China also had negotiations with Japan, South Korea about free trade. But of course, with the recent conflict over the Diaoyu-Santaku matter, the whole process may delay. Here, FDI flow by region, we already talk about inflow, outflow. We see a lot of different activities. Interestingly, the number, amount of FDI that United States continue to be most attractive destination. That is where you put your money, right? Number one, safe. Number two, profit making. So those are the two. And China, number two. If combined with Hong Kong, you can see almost match with U.S. All of those investment, we can see, and also inflow, outflow, China also catching up. We already mentioned China's activities projected globally, that is Latin America, Africa. According to one statistics, China's investment in Africa already bypassed the World Bank. Of course, there are a lot of discussion and debate over the nature and others. But even economically, China's emerged as a new economic leadership. But there are a number of elements may slow down China's economic development, not to mention that GDP per capita, China is far behind the United States, even far behind Japan. And the imbalanced picture of a coastal and inland, and also China's economic influence in international organizations such as IMF, World Bank, is far weaker than the United States, among others. There are many, many items. And also is, I already mentioned, is uncertain future for, you know, just like any other major economies, U.S., Japan, EU, each part had some uncertainty. And China now joined this situation, also full of uncertainty about its future economy. But nevertheless, what my analysis based on what have already happened up to today. So if already happened up to today, China in economic dimension indeed began to play a leading role. But if we look at other dimension, in this case, military, it's very obvious U.S. still the leading power in military security dimension. U.S. spent more annually on military, on defense, and U.S. is responsible for 44% of world total military expenditures. There is a saying that U.S. military expenditure is so big that the next 10 powers combined still below the United States. Like China, Russia, UK, Japan, South Korea, among others, if combined. So it's very clear United States still the leading military power, not only in Asia-Pacific, but also globally. And here is the picture, if you look at military expenditure. Just use this chart to illuminate the major difference between the United States. China now getting number two position, but this number we used is a Stockholm-based statistic number. So try to make that a neutral way, because there are different numbers. If you look at China, its own military expenditure number, and other numbers. Several elements we have to pay attention. One, with percentage of GDP, United States military expenditure average for the past three decades is about 4%. And Chinese military expenditure is about 2%. It's almost a pattern. So if this continues, there is no way for China to catch up with the United States militarily. Moreover, if you look at military partners, United States has a very solid partnership with the U.S.-Japan alliance, U.S.-South Korea, and with military partnership with Philippines, Australia, New Zealand, Thailand, India, Pakistan, Singapore, among others. And military exercise, very frequent with South Korea. I'm not going to go over every military exercise, particularly after Yamping and Chang'an, to deter North Korea nuclear development. With Japan, every year, U.S.-Japan alliance in a very solid foundation, more than 100 every year. Who are Chinese military partners, if we, in comparison, some people argue, well, there is an ICO, Shanghai 6, But Shanghai Six essentially is a China-Russia organization in Central Asia. It's basically anti-terrorism, not necessarily a military organization. And some people also, if you really like look at the alliance relationship, official alliance only North Korea. In North Korea, there is a treaty between China and North Korea. Still there. China, Russia already abolished. And there are also other relationships like Pakistan, Burma. Some, of course, with uncertainty. Burma-Myanmar case is most obvious with the past 2 years change. So there is a comparison of in Asia-Pacific in terms of military partnership, in terms of alliance. China is far behind the United States. It's very clear the U.S. is in a leading position. How about in political influence? We all understand Hillary Clinton, from soft power to smart power. In terms of political influence, but before I talk about it, is everybody know there is a widespread, what we call, anti-Americanism worldwide, not only with like Islam, some countries, but also even within U.S. allies, such as Japan and South Korea. Among others. However, having said that, I always said that there are four advantages in terms of U.S. foreign policy and political influence. Number one, U.S. always adjusts its foreign policy to reflect a high moral stance. What does that mean? If we look at Obama administration right after moving to White House in 2009, one of the first international action is to have a nuclear summit and to advocate abolish nuclear weapons. Of course, we all understand there's no way, not realistic today to do that, to get a consensus. However, the very summit itself indicates the effort for a high moral stance. And secondly, influence and leadership in news media very much influenced public opinion. And thirdly, strengthens international credibility to maintain alliance relationship, in this case, Japan in particular, and NATO and others. Last but not least, the self-correction ability, constant policy debate. If there is a policy wrong, like, you know, if there is debate, for example, over the war in Iraq, and then the next president may say, okay, why don't we stop? Why don't we withdraw our troops? So here, what I'm saying here is, yes, there are anti-Americanism in different corner of, but I always say the biggest voice is not in Middle East, not in Tokyo, but rather is in Washington, meaning policy debate. If we look at the war in Iraq, the most severe criticism is from public opinion, from think tank, from others in Washington, from Congress, you know, to make a self-correction of a policy. You know, same thing with the Vietnam War and others. So I would think this is a strength for U.S. foreign policy, whereas we don't really see much this kind of a policy debate in Beijing in a true sense. So if you have a foreign policy mistake, it's not easy to make correction. So those, I would say, is the produced huge gap between China and the United States in terms of a political influence. Here, there are many other numbers about public world opinion view. In general, China below United States in terms of negative or positive. But of course, there are many different public opinion survey, but this is only one of them. I always like to use South Korea as an example to have our examination of political influence, because South Korea historically very close with China in terms of culture and others, is a tributary state and heavily influenced. But at the same time, now South Korea is a military ally, alliance of the United States. So how the South Koreans look at this picture will be very interesting. 3 years ago, 2 years ago, three young researchers from Academy of Social Science, Chinese Academy of Social Science, they went to South Korea, Seoul, conducted field research for 1 year, and they had a telephone and face-to-face interview, basically asked many different questions. And then when they returned to Beijing, they published this article at Contemporary International Relations, a journal, last year. When I look at the journal, I said, well, that's a good data to reflect. At least this is the Chinese researchers' interview. It's not necessarily Korean people. So in that case, we will see if there are negative picture with China or not. We look at here, it's very similar. When ask a question of who economically could be a dominant power, more than half say China. 28% say United States. Military dimension, there is one question. If there is a military conflict between China and the United States, which side you think South Korea should be? Very interestingly, about two-thirds say, well, you know, we don't want to take a side. Neutral. 2% say we support China. 31% support the United States. So if in that sense, it's very interesting to see militarily South Korea, most of South Koreans still believe United States would be most reliable and in the future direction. But more interestingly is a political dimension. If we look at here, the researchers, they made such a design. They said, well, we would like to ask you about trustworthy political trustworthiness among those three major powers. And further, the researchers say, let's say Japan is a 50 in number. You know, the higher, the more trustful. How do you see U.S. and China? Very interesting, the researchers, they put Japan as a benchmark. It's no surprising, United States 62. But more surprisingly, China is a 42. In other words, China politically, I see, okay, is not only below to the United States, but also even below to Japan, given consideration that a colonial experience with Japan. So this is very striking. That is, in terms of political influence, China is far behind. Now, let me move a bit quick because I really want to get a Q&A part. So in that case, I just will, like, 10 seconds, one slide, so that we can have leave more time for Q&A. Okay. So Asia's regional institutions, if we look at here, they're U.S.-led, that's co-leadership, and also the co-participants with different organizations. China, on the other hand, catching up, even though we see U.S. still dominant power, but militarily, but China closing the gap. But at the same time, you know, China militarily also increased. If we look at this budget situation, is moving up quickly. And we all know that the Liaoning Hao aircraft carrier just put in use the first one. So China also made effort for its political influence rising, even though the soft power is a sore spot, we see because of this weakness of soft power, then there's enormous damage to China's core interests, like Taiwan, Tibet, and Xinjiang, and West public opinion tend to reflect some misunderstanding of the situation and to be more sympathy toward the other side. And other soft power effort, we have all those efforts, language and the Confucius Institute and others. Therefore, we see economically there are each has a strong and weakness. China economically stronger, but politically, militarily weaker. United States, on the other hand. Therefore, we have, how should we deal with that? We have a positive 3C and negative 3C. The positive 3C is a coordination with the cooperation, with the compromise, which is necessary for this peaceful due leadership. Negative 3C, with the competition, with the conflict, with the confrontation, which would divided this new leadership structure. And there are hot spots with Taiwan Strait, with also Korea Peninsula. Well, therefore, the question, U.S.-China relations, whether it's old Cold War mentality, a zero-sum game, we know there are offensive realism. John Mearsheimer of University of Chicago emphasizing it's inevitable for the two powers to clash. At the same time, other arguments, Brzezinski, Henry Kissinger, argue there would be a win-win situation possible, globalization, regional integration. And areas for potential conflict, we heard a lot recent news about this South China Sea, and also Sankaku Delhi issue, and also economic friction, right? The renminbi and other issue. And current cooperation, strategic dialogue, every year we have those, there are frequent summit, Xi Jinping, Biden, and others. Future directions. This dual leadership structure is positive so far. But if you want to sustain this dual leadership, you have to be inclusive, include other key players such as Japan, Russia, and the two Koreans. Six-party talks is one of the examples, but of course now it's a bit outdated. And the other extension of organization. And one thing I want to emphasize, this dual leadership is different from G2. G2 is global and comprehensive U.S.-China, that idea. And this dual leadership basically is a complementary of strength and weakness. It's also regional. It's only in Asia-Pacific. Thank you very much.
Okay, so we will now devote the remainder of the time to questions. If you have a question, raise your hand, speak clearly into the mic, give a little bit of information about yourself and your name.
I saw a number of hands, so in that case, why don't we have some questions, and then I will take notes, and then I will answer collectively for one first round, and then we have another round.
Okay, thank you very much for the chance given to me. My name is Alid. I'm a student here at EDU. I'm from Indonesia. Yeah. It is really interesting for me to look in the past few years about the relationship between between the US and China. But unfortunately, we all aware that there are still a lot of problems between this kind of relationship. So my question is, and I do really believe that all the people here, we see the numbers and the comparison, and we never expecting another Cold War between U.S. and China, right? So my questions to you is, what do you think is going to be the futures between U.S. and China regarding, the effort to understanding each other? Because understanding is really important. And how that going to be influence the rest of the world? Because we never be able to just ignore the rest of the world. Thank you very much.
Very good.
Hi, my name is Mary. I'm a student of political science and economics. You touched on it briefly, but I'd really love to hear your comments on the internal economic problems in China, including that the GDP per capita is only a fourth of the United States. Over 50% of the population is still living in the rural areas. And increasingly, China is dependent on the Middle East for oil, being the largest importer of oil in the world. So I'm just curious of how you see these problems affecting the United States' relationship with China in the future.
Sure. Yeah. Maybe a couple more. Yeah. Back over there. I saw there is. Oh, yes. Yes.
Yeah. Hi, my name is Abby Pike. I'm a political science student here. I noticed that you mentioned Nye's term of smart power. I'm wondering how close you feel that the U.S. and China have come to balancing hard power and soft power.
I see. Okay. Very good. I guess this is three questions for this round, and we can promise for another round, right? Yeah. Okay. Very good. Those are very good questions. About the future direction of U.S.-China relations, as I mentioned earlier, one of the key issues is inclusive. When we say leadership role, that is the two powers try to manage together peace and prosperity continue in Asia-Pacific. But you have to look at other major players, such as Russia, Japan, Korea Peninsula, ASEAN countries. ASEAN countries, I really like a question from Indonesia, that it's a key. There is an idea of ASEAN centrality and whether would continue to play this role is always a... And naturally, there are some conflicts, like the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia all have territory dispute with China in South China Sea. Japan, of course, Sankakudoyu issue, we all understand. So those issues potentially would be a source for confrontation. Actually, back to the lunch keynote speaker, Kurt Campbell, the day before yesterday, we had that question actually was asked. That is, what role the United States would play in those disputes? You know how did he answer? What he said, United States, of course, very concerned about those conflicts. But by all means, United States will be a mediator. That's what he... We don't want to get into that. We don't want to take a side. You know, but the only thing we would like to emphasize is a peaceful settlement and no coercive actions there. So it's a very interesting point, as we can see. And I'm sure there will be much consultation in the future between the United States and China. I always talk about East Asia international relations, and understand Professor Tong is going to teach that course next semester. There, historically, there are two hot spots. One, Korea Peninsula. One, Taiwan Strait. But now there are two new hot spots, South China Sea and East China Sea. So far, there are no answers yet with these two new hotspots. But I always say that, well, in order to get an answer to the new hotspots, we may have to look at the old ones, you know, how the old ones solved. And that is what I use the term, it's called co-management of the United States and China. Co-management of what? If we look at the Korea Peninsula, that is a six-party talks in which U.S. and China playing a leading role to put the situation under control. North Korea, even though still developing its nuclear weapons, but at least now the leaders understand that you have to take care of economic issues for your own people. It's still ongoing. I'm not saying the issue already solved, but I would like to say the issue at least is under control. It's not likely to become a trigger for another war between the United States, at least for the time being, and China. Another hotspot, Taiwan. Taiwan, I would say, I used a term that is for Korea Peninsula is explicit co-management. For Taiwan, I use a term is implicit co-management. Washington and Beijing work together to put Taiwan independence movement under control. Don't push envelope. Don't use that George W. Bush in front of Wen Jiabao in 2003, December, in White House, saying that we support the status quo. If any action change status quo, we will oppose. And that was right before Chen Shui-bian referendum election. Basically, stop moving toward independence, that which will trigger a war in Taiwan Strait. So I'm just using those two examples to indicate, I would think in the future for East China Sea and the South China Sea, whether you like it or not, in all related parties, then United States must play a critical role. And we'll work together with China to solve those issues, and together with ASEAN countries, with Japan. Mary's question is very good about internal backwards problems. That's a very accurate. That is, there are enormous problems. I have another lecture just listed 5-6 elements of internal issues that is may trigger some future economic slowdown, if not a crisis. That is indeed it's very critical. And now we just learned November 18th would be, is that November 8th will be the 14th Party Congress. 18th, right? So, so November 18th. 18th, November 8th. November 8th will be the 18th. Yeah, well, there's a lot of wording. Will be the 18th Party Congress, which is a very critical. That's, you know, all globally, everybody watch that, you know, if you can concern about Asia-Pacific. So it's a critical, you know, whether there will be a turning point internally, externally. And so those are the issues. We really, and that's actually an idea for China always emphasizing itself is a developing country. It's not really developed. There are still huge gaps. The last one about smart power, is I already indicated there are huge gap in terms of soft power between the United States and China. I use South Korea as an example. There are a lot of doubts, a lot of questions about that. I also use the term soft spots of China's external relations, external activities. Do we have another round? No? Oh, okay, yeah, I see. In that case, I will use this opportunity. Thank you for all your good questions, and I'm sure we will have, and welcome to Washington whenever you have a chance. Thank you. Yeah.